You're tuned to 1520 WCHE Radio, and it's time now for the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will offer reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today, and now Sam Hankin.
Afternoon, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Avid Reader. Today we welcome Paul Bogard, author of The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Light. It was just published last month by Little Brown and Company. The book chronicles light, darkness, the loss of one, the tsunami of the other one, and what the loss means to us individually and to us as a race. So welcome, Paul, and thanks very much for joining us today.
It's my pleasure to be here.
My first question would be, why are you so invested in this? Because it just comes through the pages that this is something that's so important to you.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that, you know, it stems from night has always been something that I've loved, and I still really love it. I remember being a little kid and just standing out at the end of the dock on our lake in northern Minnesota and being overwhelmed by the starry sky overhead, and then also being kind of overwhelmed by the fear of the dark in the woods when you can't see your hands in front of your face. And as I got older and started to learn about the other values of darkness for our physical health, our spiritual health, our the animals around us, and how much light pollution there is, I just really found it to be an issue that I could sink my teeth into, that mattered a lot to me, that I'm passionate about. But it all goes back to that love of night.
Well, you know, there's so many things in your book that talk about what we've lost over the past, well, not even a couple hundred years, but even further than that. And you advocate so much for attempting to ameliorate light pollution. And I guess this is the question I have is, how much do you think can be done at this point? I know we've talked about, or you talked about, downlighting, the lighting in Paris. But then again, if you look at the, and you talk about the pictures from NASA, how do you think that your book, or even all the efforts that people are making, can take us back in time? Because it almost has to.
Yeah, I mean, that's a key question. But, you know, one of the reasons that I love working with this topic is because I really do deeply believe it's something that we can do something about. And no one's saying, let's not have any light, you know, let's go back to the literal dark ages. But what a lot of people are saying, people that I talk to, is that we're simply not aware of how much light we're wasting, how much, you know, we use so much more light at night than we actually need. And the cost from that to our physical health, spiritual health, environmental health, and the waste of money, the just the bottom line, are so unnecessary that I think when people start to become aware of those costs and how unnecessary they are, I think most people will say, you know, why don't we do it differently? And there are some real opportunities for us to do it differently. The big one is the coming of LEDs, which LED lighting, electronic lighting, will eventually come everywhere because it's so much more efficient and the lights last longer. And this changing from electric lighting, the way we've been doing it for the last century or so, to electronic lighting will give us the chance to really make some steps in the right direction of getting our lights focused only downward, using not more light than we need to use, and not using light, you know, in the middle of maybe at 3 o'clock in the morning when nobody's out and about. So I think there's some real opportunities for us to really change the night.
Well, one way we can bookend, no pun intended, is when you talk about, tell us a little bit about the Luxor in Las Vegas, or Las Vegas in general, but especially at Luxor, and then in the same state, how you can find some of the darkest places. And then we can talk a little bit about that, how that scale is measured.
Sure. Yeah, the Luxor beam, for folks who don't know, is the brightest beam of light in the world. It comes out of the pyramid of the Luxor Casino on the Strip in Las Vegas. It's the beam is a combination of 36 huge spotlights. And for me, it really is just the symbol of so much that's wrong with our lighting, that we're just, you know, using it in a way that it doesn't really do anybody any good. It shines all night long. And as you said, in Nevada, I was lucky to live there for 4 years, and a wonderful state. You have Las Vegas, but you also have some of the darkest places left in the country, like Great Basin National Park, or up in the desert, the Black Rock Desert, places that you can still get out and see a really wonderful dark sky. So these two things are juxtaposed in the same state, kind of the brightest real estate we have in the country and some of the darkest.
It's funny, and I kind of say this to you with a sense of shame, but my brothers and I build kind of villages, and we do a pretty good job of it in terms of keeping 65 or 75% of the land we build on unbuilt, you know, forest. But what I feel bad about is I went to one of the meetings, this was like 10 years ago, I went to one of the meetings where we were seeking approval, and one really nice gentleman with glasses, elderly, stood up and he talked. He said he was an astronomer, and he was worried that our subdivision, our village, our town would create light pollution for his ability to view the night sky. And everyone, I wouldn't say they giggled or laughed, but everybody was like, you know, what's the big deal?
Right.
And that was the way he was perceived at that time. I don't know if that would be the same situation now. And even I thought, I don't understand what he's talking about. What is exactly does he mean?
Right, right. Yeah, you know, I think there is, that comes from probably a lot of a lack of awareness, you know, about the problem of light pollution, the many costs, how much light we waste, what it takes away from all of us. And I think probably, you know, correlated with that response is the response that a lot of folks have, that we somehow need all this light for safety and security. And, you know, that just isn't true. Light at night can certainly help us be safer and more secure, but there's a point at which more light actually makes us less safe, makes it harder for us to see at night, for example, and gives the illusion of safety so that we go out into areas we might not normally go out into, or we take risks that we might not normally take. So this notion that, you know, I think that response, you know, gets to the point, to the idea that light pollution is just an astronomer's problem. And I think what I'm hoping to do with the book is to show readers and everyone that it's all of our problem. It affects our physical health, our spiritual, mental health. That, you know, waste money, waste energy. It actually, so much light in the cities on the roadways actually contributes to dangerous condition on the roadways. So it's really affecting all of us, and it isn't just an astronomer's problem at all.
Yeah, that's interesting that you say that, because I remember when I was in Hawaii, we did a cave trip, and we went down 100 or 200 feet, and our guide said, okay, everyone turn off your lights.
Right.
And it was unsettling because you really couldn't see your hand in front of your face. You couldn't see anything. There was no light at all.
Yep.
And the juxtaposition of that in your book is that your book is always looking up. Your book is always looking up, and it's concerned, I would say, primarily with stars, the Milky Way, which is amazing and not seen by 80 or 90% of the people who are alive today in the United States. So why is it that you're so attuned to looking up, whereas the darkness I experienced was the darkest I ever experienced in my life in that situation?
Yeah, you know, I'm not an astronomer. I mean, I certainly love the night sky, and I appreciate the work that astronomers do, but I'm really coming at it from a kind of an everyman point of view, and saying, you know, the night sky is for all of us. It's not just for astronomers. I remember a friend of mine in who lives in Flagstaff, Arizona, and Flagstaff has a wonderful lighting ordinance that really keeps the level of light down, and he's very proud of that, but he said he doesn't like it when he hears people in Flagstaff say, we do this for the astronomers. And he says that's like thinking that we we protect the Grand Canyon just for the geologists, right? It's, you know, we protect the Grand Canyon for everybody, and we're doing the same thing with the night sky. But I also think that the night sky is just kind of the starting point. It's, you know, for me, I started to learn about light pollution when I began to realize how much of the sky I couldn't see. But light, you know, losing the stars is only the start of all the different problems we're dealing with. And I didn't actually go to caves because I really wanted, for example, I really wanted people to think about the night outside, the light that we were losing, that we're spreading everywhere, and the darkness that we're losing outside. And, you know, going into a cave or into a closet or into the basement or something like that wasn't really the darkness that I was looking for.
Well, you do two things that highlight the points you've just made are, one, when you talk about the Great White Way, which you also mentioned has moved up about 10 blocks. And you could talk a little bit about that. Plus, also, I think it was your mother-in-law who came out and said, what are all those white dots? I can't remember if it was your mother-in-law.
Right, yep.
Let's talk about both of those, because essentially, you know, how you say in the Times Square, it's not even that you don't see stars, you don't even know there's a sky.
Yeah, you know, that was one of the amazing experiences I had writing the book, was when I went to Times Square and I walked up Broadway, and I was impressed by how, you know, where it used to be the Great White Way, it's not even as bright there anymore as it used to be. And where it's really bright is Times Square, so bright that at least on the night I was there, I couldn't even, you know, as you said, I couldn't see a few stars. I couldn't even, it felt like a domed stadium, you know, that I was, there wasn't even a sky up there. And the story I tell is actually Bob Berman, who's a wonderful astronomy writer who lives in upstate New York. His mother-in-law came to visit them, and she had lived her whole life in Manhattan. And when she came out to visit them, she, when they opened the door, the first thing she said was, "What are all those white dots up in the sky?" And, you know, I've told that story a number of times in readings all over the country, and I sometimes get the sense that people hear that and they think, "How could anybody say that? You know, how could anybody not know what the white dots in the sky were?" But I think what she's, the point of that story is that when you live your whole life in a place, in a city, where every night you see maybe 20 stars, you have no idea what you're seeing when you get out of the car and you see 400 stars or 1,000 individual stars. That is really what she means. Like, what is that?
Yeah, I did. It is hard to believe, because I didn't believe it at first until he turns and asks his wife and she goes, "Nope."
I couldn't believe it either. Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because sometimes inner city kids, when they take the SAT, they can't answer questions, not because they lack the intelligence, but they have no experiential reference to either a cow or a chicken or the stars. And so it's not lack of the ability to reason. It's the lack of the experience of ever seeing these things.
Well, it's really true, and we're losing that experience. I notice it even, I notice it all the time, but I just saw around here, for example, that I'm home in Minnesota for the summer, and the Minnesota Orchestra is doing a concert next week that is being advertised as a concert under the stars, meaning I guess that it's outside, but there aren't going to be any stars that they're, you know, people are going to be able to see. And I think a lot of people, especially, you know, younger folks, don't even really know what that means.
Yeah, well, it's like you say in the book, and I say all the time, is people, first of all, whether it's dark or not, people don't look up anymore.
Right.
They just don't look up, and, you know, that's like one of the most important things that you can do to make yourself live a happy life. It's just, you know, it's such a great metaphor, because without looking up, you're just, it's just, like you said, it's like, if you live in Phoenix, the air conditioner's on all the time, so you don't even know you're living. Why am I living in this incredibly hot place?
Right.
And
yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, the night sky has inspired human beings ever since there've been human beings, essentially, to, you know, philosophy and religion and science and art. You know, I think about, like, Van Gogh's paintings is one of the examples that I use, and how, you know, a young Van Gogh these days is not going to be inspired by the night sky. It's just not very inspiring anymore.
Well, it's funny because one thing I like about your book and lots of books that do this is you have lots of epigraphs. And one is by Van Gogh about the night is more alive and richly colored in many ways than the day. But you do go off, I mean, you go off on this, is that when you looked at Starry Night, while other people might think that this is the ravings, the artistic ravings of a madman,
right,
you were actually able to understand, or at least intuit, that what he was seeing isn't what we can see today, so we have a very difficult time understanding it. Why don't you explain that, if you will?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love his work. I love, you know, everybody knows his painting of A Starry Night, and I think a lot of us know what that looks like with the swirling starlight and the moon and all that movement and stuff. And I think a lot of people, when they see that painting, they think, I had a great quote from Joachim Pissarro, who's the grandson of the painter Pissarro, who said, you know, people just think Van Gogh was a werewolf of energy. And that's why his painting looks the way that it does. And, you know, there's no doubt that, you know, Van Gogh was obviously an artist and creative. But the point that I make is that the night that he was being inspired by, the night sky he was being inspired by, was so much more inspiring than the one that we know. And, you know, not that it necessarily looked like what we see on his painting, but it looked so much more like that, so much more inspiring, so much more vivid. You see him writing in his letters to his brother, for example, about the colors of the stars over Paris, which is, you know, you're lucky to see any stars over Paris these days, let alone the colors of the stars. So he had a different experience than we get to have these days.
And it's really funny when you're looking at his paintings, like at the Van Gogh Museum, and you all of a sudden you look at a painting and the sky is green, and you look at it and you go, well, that's ridiculous. And then all of a sudden you look at it again and you go, no, that's right. But I can't explain why. You just have this feeling, that's right. Why is this bedroom crooked, you know? Yeah. That's because it's right, but I could never explain it.
Yeah.
So talk, you know, I tend to ramble, but talk a little bit about the darkness scale and where the average American sits on that scale.
Sure. I mean, I think this is a pretty revealing way to think about what we've lost, what we're losing, which is something called the Bortle scale. It's a 9-point scale that has 9 being our brightest places, our brightest skies, and 1 being our darkest places. And 9 would be, you know, a Las Vegas, a Times Square, or really any sort of the downtown, the center of any major city around the world. And what was really revealing to me are a couple things. The first is that most Americans, most of us, actually most of us in North America and Western Europe, spend most of our lives in levels 5 and above, and we rarely or never experience darkness on the lower end of the scale. And then the other thing is that, you know, when I started writing the book and I learned about the scale, I immediately called a guy that I know who's works with the National Park Service, Chad Moore, who's head of the Park Service Dark Sky team, and I said, Chad, where can I go to experience a level 1, you know, the darkest nights that we have? And he kind of laughed and he said, well, Australia would be a good a good place to go. And, you know, I was, you know, kind of discouraged. I said, well, no, I kind of meant like in the lower 48. And he said, well, you might get lucky from time to time. You might have a 1. But that means you're in a place where you can't see any evidence of artificial light in any direction, including up. And there just are very few places and very few nights in the lower 48 where we can get back to that original sort of primitive darkness. There's almost always a light on the horizon or some light in the sky. And that was pretty revealing to me.
Yeah, it's funny because I live in a house in near the Brandywine Creek runs through my backyard. We're 20 miles away from where our country actually started. And it was built in 1775, before the country actually started. So I'm out in the woods, And there really isn't any city near me. There's just one little town. So there is that orange, that little glow at night. But when I turn off all my lights, including the security lighting, which, as you said, doesn't need to be on all the night, when I turn that off and I can see the Seven Sisters in the Pleiades and I can see the Milky Way, it's like your epigraph about the Isaac Asimov epigraph, "Have you ever experienced darkness, young man?"
Yeah.
From Nightfall, which was like one of my favorite books when I was like 12 or 13, favorite
yeah.
stories.
Yep.
And it is, and the other thing that you talked about with the Milky Way is being somewhere where it looks like what it was named for, like this can of milk that was just thrown against the sky.
Right.
And it's not to be so metaphysical about it, but I think it does change your understanding of where you are. You still feel as minuscule as you do in the universe, but it gives you an idea of how much and where we are, because you're actually seeing a slice of our own galaxy.
Oh, I absolutely think so. I mean, people, we've lost out on the experience of both feeling, really small and kind of knowing our place. And also, I think, though, there's a feeling that can come over you of feeling zen, kind of big in a way, in a true way of understanding how important your what you do here is. I think that when we don't see the night sky, when we don't experience real darkness, we tend to get sort of an artificially inflated notion of our importance. Like we're human beings are the only thing that matters. And I think when you stare up at the Milky Way and you see, hundreds of millions of stars and you realize, wow, we're not the only thing around, it can have the effect of really realizing, like, we better take care of the world that we do have. And that's one of the things I love about the night sky as well.
Yeah, it's funny when you're traveling now, which you have been doing, when you're in airports and you see all these kids, I say kids because they're a lot younger than me, with Bluetooth headsets, they're walking back and forth. They're going to Hong Kong to sell some widgets to somebody or import mm-hmm. something back and forth. And then you see them on the airplane with their computers doing either work or playing solitaire or Candy Crush or whatever. You realize, I don't mean to generalize, but they have no reason to look up.
Yeah.
They have their everyday waking reality. And that's here. You don't really, what you don't address is the fact that why do we have this? Why do we like it so much? Why do we like Times Square to look the way it, because we do like it, we must. Why do we like Las Vegas to look the way it looks? Because you have
right.
to fight all that inertia.
Absolutely. And I think that, we like light. I mean, I think that's kind of a given. One of the examples I use about the growth of lighting in the country is the light at gas stations, for example. Our gas stations basically are about 10 times as bright as they were just 20 years ago. So it's way past the point of, it being a security thing. And there have actually been some research on this. Why do gas stations do this? And it's basically all about advertising, that, a brighter gas station will draw customers to it. And, it's interesting. I think that, Times Square or the Las Vegas Strip, those are obviously really bright, the brightest places I went to. But in some respects, I don't care that much about that. I don't, they're going to be bright. We like that. I'm not saying we should turn off all the lights in Times Square. But what I really want people to pay attention to are, like you were just talking about with your house, the lights in our, where we live, the lights on our houses, the lights on our streets, the lights in the cities and suburbs where we live. Those are the places that don't need to be lit up as bright as Las Vegas or Times Square.
And, well, the thing is, I never take it for granted. I try not to. I think of living there as like a stewardship. And
mm-hmm.
But if you live in the inner city and you can't get out because you really can't, then it's a different story. Your life is going to be different. They're not going to be able to do what you did in order to write this book, It's a shame.
I absolutely agree. And I've heard a lot of stories from people I talk to about getting folks from the city out somewhere where they can really see how bright the moon is on a full moon night, or to see the Milky Way, and just how odd people are, you know. And it's like so many things, you know, it's kind of an environmental justice issue, you know, where people who can't get out of the city to see this are the ones who are bearing the greatest burden of all this wasteful lighting.
It's funny, because while I was reading your book is when we had the perigee moon, which was really cool. And the other thing is, there's this one day in New York, I don't know if you know about this, where you can actually look up like Fifth Avenue and actually see a sunset. Because you can't. I mean, all year long you don't see a sunset, but there's one day where everything lines up like at Stonehenge.
Yep. I haven't seen it, but people sent me photos of it.
Yeah, I just saw a film, a time delay film of it, and I was realizing, you know, that's true. You can't turn around anywhere and see the sun for most of the day.
And that reminds me of something that I'm always struck with. Like, one of the most, amazing nights for me in the book is when I go to Death Valley near the end of the book, and I have that experience of being out in the desert in Death Valley, watching, you know, stars rising from one horizon and basically falling off the earth, you know, on the other horizon. And talk about something that we've lost. This, you know, there aren't very many places you can go now, certainly not New York or any city, where you can see stars at the horizon. They tend to kind of start, you know, midway up the horizon. And so I think a lot of people probably think that's just the way it is. But in fact, no, you know, stars start where the planet ends. And that's something we've lost as well.
Yeah, you talk about how you don't want to go. Some guy says, come on, I need to see the stars, but I only have 5 minutes.
Right. exactly.
But, you know, a lot of your book, I mean, not a lot, but a good portion of your book discusses the concept of night vision and how we've lost it. And you also go off a little bit into rods and cones. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that, too.
Sure. I think, you know, it relates to everything we've been talking about, which is just that, you know, most of us don't really know how amazing our eyes are. And on one level, you know, human beings haven't really evolved to see well at night. But boy, we see a lot better at night in the dark than we think we do. It's just that we never, you know, get around to being out long enough to have our eyes adjust. And that story that you mentioned, which I love, is when I was out in Death Valley with Stan Dorisco, who's another member of the Park Service. He told me about how, you know, he'll get people who drive out from Las Vegas and say to him, you know, show me the night sky, I got about 5 minutes. And the amazing thing about, for me, was that, and here, you know, I'm somebody who's written this book and who spent a lot of time out at night, is that experience of, you know, if you go outside and you're in the dark for 10 minutes, you're going to start to see better. And then after 45 minutes, you'll see a lot better. But if you're out in the dark, you know, especially in a place like Death Valley under the stars, if you're out there for 2 or 3 hours, there's something that happens that it just, for me, it was like, you know, being given a new set of lenses. It just, all of a sudden, I just saw these even more. It's really, really pretty amazing. And that's, again, another experience that most people never have. There's an estimate now that it's something like 40% of Americans and Western Europeans never experience night vision. Their eyes never fully adjust to night vision, because they go from being in lighting all day long to being in lighting inside until they go to bed.
Yeah, that's true. And then they stay awake for a few minutes and they go to sleep, which is really their only darkness. It's funny because the analogy you use is when you go to the optometrist and he says, is it better now or better now?
Right.
And that is kind of a moment of epiphany when you're getting new glasses.
Absolutely.
You realize, wait, I can really see clearly now.
Yep.
And so that really hit home for me, because I don't have really bad vision, but I do need glasses. And having the right, I mean, if you have the wrong glasses, it's like what you're saying. You don't see. What you see is not what's there.
Right.
And one of the other interesting things in your book is how you are unsettled when you get to the point where you actually have adjusted and you actually are in one of these number one places, you feel almost like as if you're falling away. You know what I mean? You talk about that. It's very unsettling, almost as if you're in a different, an altered state of consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a pretty remarkable experience. And again, something that we've by and large lost now, that feeling. There's even a term for it. They call it celestial vaulting, this feeling of that you're kind of falling into the stars. You know, talk about a pretty amazing experience that that used to be, you know, it used to be commonplace, and now we've lost it. And that's one of the, you know, things that I say again and again when I'm talking to folks, which is, you know, we've taken what was, you know, one of the most common human experiences, which is walking out at night and coming face to face with the universe, and we've made that one of the most rare of human experiences. And I think whether it's having this just sort of amazing physical feeling or all the other things we've talked about, you know, I'm really taken back to your story of the, you know, people kind of chuckling at the astronomer, you know, worried about the light pollution or whatever. It's just, it reminds me of, you know, the researcher at Harvard who said to me, you know, we are, with our understanding of light affecting our body, kind of where we were with smoking in the 1950s, you know. And he's convinced that eventually people will realize how much we're losing with all this light and how dangerous it is for us. But right now, as it probably was in the 50s, when you say, you know, this is dangerous, people kind of chuckle and say, ugh, you know, why are you worried about it? This isn't that big a deal. It really is a big deal.
Talk about the different, to get clinical, talk about the different types of lighting intrusion that there are. I think you mentioned four. I think there's four of them in that scale you talked about. You know, like, like an easement, like bothering your neighbors with your security lighting, that kind of thing.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, the way that we kind of break down this term light pollution is to talk about a couple other, I usually talk about three other terms. One is sky glow, which you mentioned is that kind of yellow orangish glow over any city of any size, especially on cloudy nights. We know it then. And in fact, there's a study out of Germany that talks about how, has shown how on cloudy nights, the clouds actually amplify the light in cities by about 10 times. So it really makes a huge difference.
Wow.
The other one is light trespass, which is really one that I think, you know, people, when they hear it, they think, oh yeah, I know what that means. It's when light from one property shines on to another property. And it's, you know, it always kind of amuses me that we live in this country where we're so obsessed with property rights, and yet when it comes to light at night, we just, you know, spray our light all over the place. And if it's shining into our neighbor's bedroom, you know, that's their problem. They should get shades, you know.
I know. It's like when you have a neighbor that has a really loud dog that barks all night long. It's like, what you want to do something, but what can you really do? There isn't much you can do. But it would be horrible. I know. There's like, what about houses that are on the street corner? I know one specifically. So every time a car comes by, every single time a car comes by, the headlights shine directly into the living room.
Well, and that brings me to the other term that we use, which is glare, which is, you know, people kind of know that word. It's light that's just basically blinding. And there's way too much glaring light, and it gets at lights that are unshielded or not properly shielded. And, you know, glare makes it hard for you to see. And I think, you know, when it comes to cars, for example, we're seeing a lot more car headlights that, and everybody knows what this looks like, there's a car coming at you with these new headlights, and it blinds you. It makes it hard for you to see. Or, you know, electronic billboards, LED billboards that are spreading all over the country that, you know, by definition are designed to take your eyes off the road and put them on the billboard. You know, it's supposed to draw your attention, and these are all really dangerous things that are related to lighting that we haven't been encouraged to think about and say, you know, maybe it isn't the greatest thing if I'm driving and I'm suddenly blinded.
Yeah, it's funny. In Philadelphia, it's even worse. There's this one building, I think it's the GE building or was, and you're driving by the biggest, you're driving on the biggest arterial there is in Philadelphia, and at the top they have this light scroll, like 60 floors up, of news of the day. And you can't help it. You look up and you're putting yourself at great, great risk, and I can't even believe that they still allow it to exist. But it's true.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about, you kind of wax nostalgic over gaslighting in, say, England and London, and then how it turned into this horrible thing, arc lighting, and then it turned into this, once again, warm kind of incandescent light. Just talk a little bit about the history of that.
Well, it's pretty interesting. I mean, you know, gaslighting can be quite beautiful. It's the color of the flame is one that we're attracted to, and it's much less bright than the light that we know today. In fact, you know, one of the things that people don't realize is that so many of the fixtures that we use, so many of the streetlight fixtures, for example, or the fixtures that you can buy, you know, in a hardware store, home improvement store, are basically gas lamp fixtures that were designed for, you know, light that was much dimmer. So when you put in an electric light, it's just, you know, you're blasting light in all directions. But basically what people have seen is that, you know, once electric lights came out, well, first of all, the arc lights didn't make anybody happy. They were so bright that they really became impractical, especially for use in the home. But then when you got to electric lighting, people liked how they liked them, and there is a lot of advantages to them over gas lighting. The thing that stands out to me, I guess I would say, is that through this development from gas lighting to arc lighting to electronic lighting, or electric lighting and potentially to electronic lighting, is that we basically get used to the new level of light and we like it and we want even more. And so you just get more used to it. That's, again, you think about how bright gas stations are now. And there's really no, as I said, there's no justification for safety in terms of how bright they are, but we're just used to it and we like it. And to tell somebody now, you know, we don't need that much light and maybe we could lower it, it's really hard for us to accept because we've just gotten used to what it looks like.
Yeah, it's funny. The story you tell about how there's still men who light the gas lights in London, and how it's a kind of a closed society, but a very nice closed society. But the saddest part of your book to me was the fact that you had a gas light and then right above it. Go ahead and tell me that one.
Sure. I mean, you know, there are about six gas lamp lighters left in London, and I got to hang out with a couple of them. The gas lamps in certain sections of London are really beautiful, and they create this beautiful atmosphere. But there was one particular one that I talk about where just above this gas lamp was a super bright, glaring electric light. It just kind of wiped out all, you know, any ambience that the gas lamp would have provided. And it just spoke to me about sort of the lack of consciousness about what we're doing, that we're just not even paying attention to the way that, you know, we're kind of over-lighting everything and wiping out the ambiance that the gas light might have created. And that's, you know, when I went to Paris, that's the difference that I saw with Paris. And not that Paris has plenty of light and problems with light pollution as well, but at least they are very conscious about the atmosphere that they're trying to create with their lighting, and there's a lot more attention to the beauty of light at night, say, than there are in most American cities.
Yeah, there's an interesting progression when you talk about the Eiffel Tower, because it goes back to the exposition when you say that Eiffel he won out over the other idea, which was what? Go ahead and talk.
Oh, the sun tower. Yeah, the tower that was going to have arc lights on it, and in the middle of Paris, it was going to make Paris as bright as day. And kind of, thank goodness, the Eiffel Tower went out.
But then again, as you say, and I was just in Paris, now they've turned the Eiffel Tower into the same kind of thing as something in Vegas with different light shows and things like that.
Yeah, it's too bad. I mean, that's... but I think, you know, again, one thing about Paris, and I think they're still doing this, they were doing this when I was there, is that they, and this is true of London as well, they turn the lights off at 1 o'clock in the morning.
That's true.
Yeah. And so I think, you know, again, that's my approach with this. I don't want, you know, anybody listening, again, to think that I don't think we should have lights. I actually think light at night is incredibly beautiful. I loved being in Paris, for example, but, you know, do we really need all this light on all night long? You know, does anybody need to have the Houses of Parliament in London lit at 3 o'clock in the morning? You know, the English have decided, no, that's ridiculous. And the French have decided, even in the City of Light, we don't need to have all our monuments lit at 3 or 4 in the morning, you know? And I just think that that kind of reasonable approach to light at night is something that we could learn from a lot more here in the States.
It's interesting how you approach the book from, at least in my opinion, from two different sides. Like, if you look at one of your epigraphs, which is from François Joux, which is about, you know, taking this to City Hall, and that was written in 2010, which is like, you know, let's do something about it. Mm-hmm. But your other epigraphs, like from Annie Dillard about being strangers to darkness, or if you go to Rilke and, you know, the dark embraces and things like that. So you're looking at it from okay, I don't want this anymore. I think we need to change this. This is how I think we can alter it in the future. But you're also looking at it from an angle of it's spiritual.
Mm-hmm.
So it's too...
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I think that, and that's a really, I guess the challenge with when you're talking about the spiritual angle is that it's nearly impossible or maybe totally impossible to put a dollar sign on it. And since we tend to use dollar signs to place value on things so much, it's hard to, you know, get people's attention. But, for me, as I said, ever since I was a little kid, and certainly now, and throughout human history, you think of somebody like St. John of the Cross talking about a dark night of the soul, the value of darkness for our spiritual life is invaluable. I mean, the truth of being alive is that you will be in periods of darkness. It is a natural part of life, and to think that we can just kind of push all the darkness away, whether it's with our artificial lights or, as I say metaphorically, our obsession with artificial lights, you know, don't worry, be happy. You know, I just think that it's not what being a human being is, and that so much richness comes out of dark times in our lives, that it's a real loss.
Well, you know, it's funny because, you know, as whether it's Shakespearean or not, it's our lives are rounded by two darknesses, essentially. We've been, you know, you're dark for an infinite period of time. Then you pop up out of this dark, dark ocean and you look around and you see this stuff and then you go back down. That's why it's not really why I'm not afraid of dying, because that infinite period before I was born is not going to be that much different than that infinite period after I die. And those are two darknesses. And what I wrestled with in your book was the difference between the concept of black and the concept of darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And there obviously is, but if you could articulate to me what that means.
Well, you know, it's a big subject. I have some academic friends who wanted me to spend the whole book talking about that kind of darkness and blackness. But I think that, you know, for me, I mean, if we just go back to the night sky, for example, or to what we think of as a natural night, it isn't black, you know, it isn't even, we often say pitch black, you know. What I was really interested in is darkness, and always in darkness there is some light. Oftentimes it's the most beautiful light, or as, you know, poets have said throughout time, you know, it's often and this is in the Bible as well, you know, it's often in the darkest times or the darkest places that we really see the light, you know. So I think that's really what I'm trying to get folks to pay attention to is not so much the maybe the blackness of, you know, being in a cave and having them say turn off the lights, but it's really like walking outside at night and realizing that you know, we all life on Earth evolved with darkness and with light, and it's half our life. It's really important for us.
Yeah, it's like if you don't have the darkness, you can't see the light. And so in some sense, your book is about light in many senses. It's like that one section you talk about, the star Rigel and the constellation it's in. And if it's such a bright object that if it was brought to the same spot where the remainder of the stars in that constellation were, we'd be basically living on Earth in a constant Las Vegas.
Exactly. And yeah, I mean, you know, all anybody has to do is walk outside during the day and they'll know what we're talking about. You know, there are obviously stars above us. You know, right now I'm talking to you midday. There are stars above us right now, and you can't see them because of our really bright star that's blocking everything out. So.
Yeah, what's Rigel like? 50? What's how many times brighter than the sun is it?
I don't remember actually, but it was so much brighter. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's going back to the idea of ameliorating all this. A part of it is essentially psychologically recognizing that this is not healthy for us and it's kind of dumb. Mm-hmm. So therefore, let's change our lighting patterns in terms of time and placement. Another one is shielding the light that we have so that it's only lighting those areas that need to be lighted for purposes of security or aesthetics or whatever. But then you're still, like I said, what the uphill part of the battle that I see you fighting is simply that people don't recognize a need, just the same with global warming. Mm-hmm. They don't recognize the need. And I understand that you don't expect your book to make it all better, but why don't you talk about what would be the processes that would make it better, mm-hmm, if you ticked them off?
You know, for me, so much of it is comes down to an awareness. First of all, I choose to be optimistic about light pollution because I know it's something that we can do something about, and that I think that, you know, once people become aware of how dumb it is, how we don't need all this light, that they'll be open to making reasonable change. And I do, you know, I obviously care a lot about what's happening with climate change, and I see working with light pollution, for example, as one piece of that. It's hard to imagine that people are not aware of what's happening because of our changing climate, although I think people maybe aren't aware of the severity of what's happening. And then I think, you know, a lot of people are consciously unaware, that they're choosing not to be aware. And, you know, I read about Aldo Leopold, who a lot of people probably who are listening would recognize from his book, Fan County Almanac, published in the 40s, and he talked about, you know, choosing what you're going to do. Are you just going to, you know, throw up your hands and kind of say, well, that's none of my business, or are you going to try to do what you can to make things better? And I think, you know, I've chosen to do the latter.
Well, to end it all, not to keep you longer than you than, you know, than it would be comfortable for you, talk about at the very end how you have that section where you just mention the six nights that you want to see, if you have those in your mind at this moment.
Yeah, I don't have that in front of me, but I could I know that if I recall, the first one was maybe the night in Morocco that I talk about.
Yeah, that was my favorite.
That's when I was 18 and I was backpacking, I had an experience of being in Morocco, which it was an experience of to go back to the Bortle scale, a level one, that there was no artificial, no evidence of any artificial light. And I just remember, you know, growing up in Minnesota, my first thought when I saw that was that it was snowing, and it was just that there were so many stars. And I'd love to see that again. Nights in Paris, we talked about Paris. I think that's one of them, that, you know, just the beauty of the light and the darkness in Paris. What are some other ones that I mentioned?
I can't remember. I don't have that page open either.
Okay.
But the main thing was that there are, the point I was trying to make was, especially with the one in Morocco, is that the darkest night isn't necessary. Who was the gentleman who said the darkest night isn't necessarily in a place? It's where you experienced it.
Right.
You know, he can't tell you point on a map where it is, because it's not. For everybody else, it's, for everyone it's different for a lot of reasons.
Exactly. And that was Dan DeRisco from the Park Service when we were out in Death Valley. And, you know, here's a guy who, his job for the Park Service is to go around to the various Park Service areas and measure the darkness there to see what we have, to see what we can protect. And he told me that he's been to over 200 different locations, and he's given three of those places a level one there. And I said, I basically was kind of like, well, tell me where to go, you know. And he said, and that's when he said, I really can't tell you where to go, because it depends from night to night and where you are and your experience. He can tell me some great stories about places he's been, and he can, obviously, you're going to have a better chance of seeing an amazing night if you're in Death Valley versus, 100 miles away in Las Vegas. But who knows when it's going to happen? And that's part of the magic of it, too. No night is always the same. I kind of like that.
Me too. And yeah, I think the best way to end it is that this book is about magic in a way, you know, and it's the more magic we forget in our lives, the less worthy I think our lives become. So I think that was what I took away from the book, that it's about a certain kind of magic.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree. A magic, and then I just think too, a love of this world and what we have, and a sadness that what we've lost and what we're losing, but an optimism that it's still out there and we can get it back.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. I really enjoyed this. I could have gone on with, I wrote these notes and I have so many questions, but I really appreciate you taking the time to answer them, and I highly recommend your book to anybody.
Thank you. It's been a real pleasure for me.
Likewise. Talk to you soon. That was Paul Bogard. We were talking about his book, The End of Night, Searching for Natural Darkness in an Age of Artificial Life. And once again, I think in one of the last interviews I had about science, or we've been doing a lot of nonfiction. I think it was The Fourth Revolution, about changing political processes. These guys are much more optimistic than I am. I wish I was. But it's important that what we recognize and take away from this show is the idea that you do want your kids to see the Milky Way. You do want them to look up and to be able to identify the constellations. And it's not just because it's knowledge. It's because it is, as we talked about at the end there, a kind of magic. And the more magic we preserve in our day-to-day waking realities, the more we remain human. And the more, depending on whether you're spiritual or not, the more you come closer to the divine. It's like, you know, should a man's reach exceed his grasp, or what's a heaven for? I think we should always be striving to go further than what we seem to think is possible. And preserving the night is a good way to start. So it was a great book. It may sound as if it's dry. It's not. It's got a good sense of humor in it, as we discussed a couple of times. But primarily, it talks to us about what we've lost and what we would have to do to regain it. And then, you know, I'm sticking with these. I love science books. So, yeah, and I love all the novels and stuff like that we've been doing for the past 3 or 4 years. But next week we'll be talking to Dave Goldberg, who's the director of undergraduate studies and professor of physics at Drexel. And hopefully he'll come out to the bookstore and sign for us. He's going to discuss it'll be released in paperback by the time we interview him, The Universe in the Rearview Mirror, How Hidden Symmetries Shape Reality. So it explores, I guess, a key to understanding our universe through symmetry. whether it's super string theory or whether we're talking about the Higgs boson, which has recently got lots of news because it's like, hey, the Higgs boson really shouldn't have existed the way we think it did. And if it did, the universe really shouldn't be here in the first place. So he talks about that. He talks about antimatter and how the universe is essentially shaped by these hidden symmetries, many of which he uncovers for us and unravels for us. So join us next week for that. Dave Goldberg, professor of physics at Drexel University. And I try to mix this up, but it just so happened that the authors we got recently are all science writers or writers who are writing about practical nonfiction matters that I find fascinating. So it's a nice switch for us. I like it. So anyway, join us again next week. Thank you so much for listening, and come and visit us at the Wellington Square Bookshop, just off the Downingtown Interchange of the Turnpike, right across the street in Eagleview, and right above Brickside Restaurant. So we look forward to seeing you, and we look forward to you being here to listen to us next week. So, talk to you soon.
You've been listening to the Avid Reader Show with your host, Sam Hankin. Sam will be back next week with reviews and interviews of some of the more interesting books and authors of today.